Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Cinemental.
Now, this I can do.
I can't compete with you physically, and you're no match for my brain.
I don't give a crap if you covered yourself in peanut butter and had a 15-hooker gangbang.
I'm Steve Hovicki, and as usual, I'm joined by my co-hosts, Hassan Godwin and Lathan Conger III. Good evening, gentlemen. How was your week?
I was home all week, strangely enough. I don't know if anybody else had that experience,
didn't
but I'm
anywhere?
Kind of a shut-in, yeah, and I'm not allowed to go outside for some reason. But I think it's all a joke being played on me, because I see a lot of people outside.
It's a cruel joke, Hassan.
I think so. I think they just want me to stay indoors.
I went out and braved the threat of people marching down the street that never came. So I'm,
very nice.
I had a decent week, but I was excited for this week's Cinemental. So
the protest that never was.
Yeah, the protest that never got near me in my suburban environment. Let's put it that way.
All right, so let's get into it.
Right.
A little bit of news that gives us fits.
Move! Okay,
so I'm going to jump off here with a couple of things. First of all, once again, we have fans clamoring for another director's cut, this one of Revenge of the Sith. Supposedly, there is a rumored director's cut that Lucas had of Revenge of the Sith that ran nearly 4 hours long. And so, as is usual, a bunch of fans slash morons jumped on to change.org and started a petition. And they have, as of this morning, they were rapidly approaching 25,000 signatures. I feel like there's almost should be now a show dedicated just to director's cuts.
Or fan-wanted director's cuts.
Yeah. I mean, I don't...
25,000 signatures, that will turn the needle in a country of 300 million in a world of 7 or 8 billion.
Yeah.
You know, that'll get us somewhere. Couple of hundred years,
but those 25,000 25,000 people could all be erased right now, and nobody would even know. You know, just unbelievable.
Lucas is not going to put forth the effort to put out the 4-hour director's cut.
No,
the prequels, however malign they are, I mean, Revenge of the Sith is probably, I would say, consensus the best of the prequels, right?
I would agree.
So,
it's my favorite Star Wars movie.
Oh wow, that's cool.
Yeah.
Really.
Yeah.
It's definitely a good movie.
It took time. It took time for it to grow on me. There are reasons for it.
Okay.
Which we don't need to go into. I mean, and I'm not talking to you about it. I'm just saying you don't have to worry. I'm not about to soapbox about it.
Right.
Here and now.
No.
But there's reasons for it. I think A New Hope is the greatest one because it's the one that started it. I think Empire Strikes Back is the strongest movie in the group, but I think Revenge of the Sith is my favorite just because of just because of the heaviness of the film. It's just a really well done story. If we take out some of the other caveats,
right,
it's a really well done story.
It's the darkest for sure of the 9 movies.
Oh yeah, that's
11.
Ugh.
Counting up there, right.
So in
I believe you are right.
In even more director's cut news, this happened over the weekend, and I just found it hysterical. So I just want to mention it real fast. Some fans on Twitter, as they are wont to do, commented that, you know, somebody made a comment about Josh Trank's original cut of Fantastic Four, because, you know, when that film came out, he went on and on about how his cut was so much different, and they went back and reshot all this stuff and everything. So some fans apparently started ringing the bell about his director's cut, and he simply replied, "No need."
That was the end of that change.org petition.
So he's the one who banged on about, like, how it was a different film and how, you know, he wished that we could have seen his original vision or whatever. And then the minute people started to nibble on it, he's like, no, back up.
Well, you know, at the time he was just looking to distance himself from the debacle that it is. And, you know, mm-hmm. when he comes out and says, listen, when a guy comes out and says that 25% of his film is in the final cut that you see, clearly he made a different film.
Well, sure.
Yeah. Right.
You know? Right. I mean, that's insane. That's an insane amount to cut a guy. I mean, that's approximately the same amount of footage Snyder is saying that was in the Justice League we saw. He's claiming that only 25% of his film is what you saw in Justice League.
That's, you're getting into payback territory.
I know. I agree.
At that point.
I agree.
You know, because if you remember, the original cut of Payback came out a couple of years ago, and it's an utterly different film than the one that was released.
Yeah.
The one with Mel Gibson?
Yeah.
Yes.
I never saw it.
It's virtually the same film. It's just like an alternate universe film. It's like...
Yeah, it's a movie. It's a story that's been told 100 times.
Right.
I love that story so much, you know. It's been done in the 60s, in the 70s, in the 80s. It's been done in every decade in some fashion or another.
Yes.
Based on the old Parker story, the Richard Stark Parker series. So, you know, every version has its own little twist to it because they usually take the sort of really kind of He-Man action guy of whatever decade we are in and toss him into that role. And that's what we get. And that's fine. I like the story. I'll watch 10 more versions of that movie before I die, probably.
Right.
But yeah, there's
both
no reason.
Versions are good. They're just astonishingly different.
They
are the same movie until they diverge, and they diverge so abruptly that you're like, oh my God, I didn't realize, you know.
But that's good though, because if you're going to go back and remake a film, you should be putting something new into it. You just shouldn't, you know, Gus Van Sant had his own thing about doing a shot for shot remake of Psycho, and that's all well and good. You know, kudos to him. Nice job. But I would rather have seen him take that story and do something else with it.
Or leave it alone.
Or you could be Michael Haneke, who remakes his own movie Funny Game shot for shot.
I know.
Just with American actors. And you're just like, okay, why didn't you just tell people you can read subtitles and watch the first one? I don't get it.
Or just fucking dub it.
Len Wiseman's remake of Total Recall, which is not shot for shot.
I didn't see it.
Yeah, I didn't see it either.
The thing I will say about it, this kind of will be spoilery. Because if you've seen, I assume, the Verhoeven version, right?
Of course.
I've seen, okay. It's not, the story beats are locked in from the original to the point where you kind of know what's going to happen. You know where the pitfalls are. You know who's going to betray who. You know who's going to, you know, they gender swap one or two characters. But ultimately, it's kind of, it's the same film.
Yeah.
With a different circumstance. But you kind of already know the payoff of all it once it's all locked in together. There's some really great stuff in the film.
Well, I mean, that's the story.
Yes. From my recollection, we can remember For You Wholesale was almost nothing like Total Recall in and of itself.
That's true. That's true. There's very few of the Philip K. Dick adaptations are very much like the original stories.
Yeah, because I think it would be turning audience members into psychotic individuals.
Or putting them to sleep.
See,
I'm not a big fan of Dick's
work. I was being delicate.
He's acquired taste, for sure.
One thing you'll appreciate is Richard Stark was talking about one time they asked him what was the hardest thing about writing the novels. He said, honestly, I could never come up with a phrase better than Parker park the car. He said, I spent my entire career trying to look for a better way of describing him parking the car.
Nice.
So I'm sorry.
So the other bit that I saw this week that I was just that had me literally bust out laughing. I'm gonna guess that both of you know who Simon Kinberg is.
I do not.
Okay, Simon Kinberg is the man who has owned the rights to X-Men since he bought them from Marvel.
Okay,
so he has been the man behind the X-Men franchise for Fox,
cashing in,
and finally got into the director's chair for the final chapter, Dark Phoenix. Okay. But everything else, he has executive produced everything else. So Simon Big Kinberg came out this week and said he would love to reboot the X-Men within the MCU. I bet he would.
Yeah.
I'm just like,
oh my God.
How is this new? I'm like, how is this news? That's just, it's wish fulfillment is what it is.
Didn't Disney eat Fox just to make sure that could happen anyway?
Eat
so
them. Yeah.
didn't they consume them in the greedy maw of the insatiable Disney beast consume all of
Fox? but herein lies the rub. If Kinberg owns the rights, and as long as he keeps making movies, he maintains a hold over those rights, even if it is under Fox.
But why would he? He'd be a moron to try to compete against himself, you know.
I don't disagree with you. I don't disagree with you.
That's kind of an easy sale. That's like an easy bake oven right there.
There are a couple of stories posted this week on varying stages. Apparently, Passion of the Christ 2 is in talks.
What's the subtitle? Electric Boogaloo?
Yeah. So, and here's something I never noticed. So, apparently, Jim Caviezel, who I never noticed his initials were GJC.
Oh, boy.
Is quoted on how important this film would be. And Randall Wallace, who is writing the screenplay, said it could be the Mount Everest of movies.
Okay. Well, I remember when I went and saw Passion of the Christ at our local AMC 30. I just remember watching the violence in the film and looking over to my left and seeing 8, 7, and 6-year-old kids in there and almost getting up and screaming. But I did at the end boo very viciously. It's not even a bad movie. I was booing the audience for making the decision of bringing their children to that movie. I believe it was on Easter. Wasn't it released on Easter or something like that?
I think so.
So that weekend. Yeah, I remember. I'll have to look up that experience. But I wasn't booing the movie. I think I gave the movie 2 3/4, to be fair. And I just couldn't believe there were kids watching this horrible, awful violence in the theater. That's what I remember most about that. So maybe for the sequel, they'll get 1 and 2 and 3-year-olds in there or something. I don't know.
I read that in the sequel, Jesus will fight Predator.
Ooh.
Now that I'd see. That sounds awesome.
I'm on board.
One of the reasons that they're really pushing to get that back. They're trying to relaunch Predator, and they're trying to relaunch Christ. So I think.
Ooh, how about JC versus JCVD?
Oh, that's great. The acronym possibilities are off the charts, Steve. JCV, JCVD. Yeah, that's pretty good. You're listening to a lot. This is a moneymaker.
Well, we're done with the evangelical crowd.
Yeah, okay. Thanks, evangelical crowd. We won't be...
I'll actually go further than Latham and say that I very much enjoyed the film. I thought it was well done. I thought it was a very good film. Just because, you know, listen, I don't know how many of my listeners I want to piss off this, you know, this early off in the life of the podcast, but the Bible is a great bunch of stories. It's great material. It really is. You know, there's been some fine films based on stories out of the Bible, but they're stories. That's it. They're not meant
to. I enjoyed it too. But it was a oneer, you know? It's kind of like a no.
But yes.
You just call it a oneer?
It was a oneer.
Yeah.
Yeah, I love that term. I'll never watch it again.
It's not going back. Well, yeah. And it was an important film to watch, whether or not you have ties with the religion or not. I have, you know, I grew up Southern Baptist with very religious grandparents. So you know, it's an important film.
It's important to know.
It's not a quotable. You know, it's not one of those movies that you, hey, man, let's pop in Passion. You know, that's not happening on a Friday night. So, like I said, it's a wonder.
It's good evidence for the degradation of Mel Gibson's mental state, too, because it was already starting at Braveheart, and it just goes down a ski hill from there. So,
Yeah, poor guy.
Leigh, have you watched any of his recent stuff?
I have not, to be honest.
Have you watched Get the Gringo? Have you watched
Apocalypto? Is amazing.
Oh no, I saw Apocalypto. I don't. I think that's nearing the jump at the end of the hill.
Oh, that's pre-jump. Yes. No, his new stuff he's had come out in the last couple of years. Get the Gringo, Blood Father.
Yeah.
Any of that stuff?
No.
It really harkens back to his earlier, just straight ahead sort of action drama.
He's not directing those movies though, right?
Absolutely not.
Yeah. I mean, that's what I'm talking about him. The ski hill begins when he starts directing The Man Without a Face. And then it just, you know, Braveheart, it's a great film, but it's
right.
His angst towards his father. The skis are racing forward at that point. So,
okay. Mm-hmm. But what about Hacksaw Ridge?
I mean, it's a pretty violent movie. That's another winner. I mean,
I've seen it almost 3 times in the last month and a half alone.
Okay. Well, he just wanted to see people get, you know, his violence is clear and it leaves nothing to your imagination. And that's an important aspect of his directing and his.
Right. But you can argue the same thing the first 25 minutes of Saving Private Ryan.
But not all of his movies are that way.
That's true. That's true, but I think that his unwillingness to shy away from violence in any form, regardless of the time period or the story he's telling, doesn't necessarily dictate a state of mind for him.
Well, it's hard to separate the pop culture from when you hear the call he makes on the phone to what, that was his daughter or...
It was his ex-girlfriend, whatever it was.
Anti-Semitic stuff he said that was truly awful.
It wasn't anti-Semitic. He said the anti-Semitic stuff to the cops.
That's right.
At that time when he was drunk.
Yeah, sorry. Yeah.
The call to his girlfriend was another kind of discrimination.
Okay, my bad. Yep.
And I agree. It's tough to listen to that. And
yeah, it's a good point.
It's
hard though. There's like, you know, Tom Cruise, I think, is a brilliant actor. He's just an absolute nutcase in real life. And it sucks because half your mind wants to praise the actor in him and all he's accomplished. And then you can't turn off the other side of your mind that remembers what he's done. And that's
right. You want these guys to be guys you want to hang out with in real life.
Well, that or just be somewhat, you know, that there's lines. And I think the Tom Cruise and Mel Gibson lines are pretty low.
Okay. So, what about Kevin Spacey?
I mean, same thing. I mean, it's tough. Is that a good guy? And I don't know. Are you a good guy, Kevin? You listening to our podcast? I don't think so.
not to take us there, but I mean,
yeah,
you gotta, I would never be able to read anybody, you know, read or you know, any of the classics, sure, or watch most of those old movies if I kind of got caught up in that. And that's not me telling you that you gotta get over it. I'm just saying in general, you just kind of
there's no right answer,
because you couldn't read Burroughs. Look at all the Edgar Rice Burroughs you'd miss out on as an African American, he's kind of tough on the brothers and some of those stories. Let's just put it that way.
I mean, and, Birth of a Nation is a film everyone should see. You know,
yeah, it's a winner.
It's just massively horribly racist. So,
I totally get what you're saying. I think like Apocalypto, like I think his movies are interesting, but it's kind of a Tarantino-esque kind of situation. They're interesting because he made them, you know, and
you nailed it. That's
he's such a character. He's such a controversial figure. And they've got the virtue of not being bad movies, of being really good movies at the same time. So he's crazy. His movies come out really good, and he's ostracized kind of from this community, the mainstream community.
He is now, yeah.
And you just can't, you know, you can't just take it in any one way. You got to have a kind of nuanced look at all of it to be able to digest any of it. So it's kind of fascinating, you know.
It's a part of art that we, most people, don't even think about or discuss. It's the balance between art and the people creating it and what you think of them is, you know, most people just want entertainment and aren't even going to consider anything in regards to their personal lives or whatever. So,
yeah, my favorite Western of all time is The Outlaw Josie Wales.
Okay.
And I just found out some unpleasant things about the man who wrote Gone to Texas, which is a novel that the movie is based on. So, you know, what do I do?
The first time you saw it.
There's no choice. You know, I ain't walking away from Josie Wales. I really, it's a fantastic film. So
that's your favorite Western.
Yeah. That's my all time favorite Western. I will not say it's the best Western, but it's definitely my favorite.
The best Western. Lay, what's your favorite Western?
Good, the Bad, and the Ugly.
Okay.
Whew, nice one.
Mine is Unforgiven.
Yeah, that's a close second. That's a close second for me.
I maintain that Unforgiven is, if you're a fan of Westerns in general, I've felt this. I literally, this was one of the first things I said when I walked out of the theater from it. I felt like that Unforgiven gave you everything you've never seen in a Western.
It played against type for sure.
I just really felt like it showed you the other side of kind of what you see mostly in Westerns and expect to see in Westerns. I felt like it kind of filled in all the gaps, all the stuff that you wouldn't normally see.
Okay.
It's definitely can stand in as closure for all of his iconic Western characters.
Oh, yeah.
You know, the Nameless Stranger, the Preacher, Josie Wales, all of those.
It's absolutely his shootist.
Yes.
Yep.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah, it's
wow.
I can't disagree with that.
From there, we move on to our feature film, Heat.
Guy told me one time, don't let yourself get attached to anything you are not willing to walk out on in 30 seconds flat if you feel the heat around the corner.
For me, the sun rises and sets with it.
It's a lot of money. What are you doing? What do you mean, forget the money?
What am I doing? I'm talking to an empty telephone.
I don't understand.
Because there was a dead man on the other end of this fucking line.
I get mixed up with that bitch.
Because she got a great ass! And you got your head all the way up it!
From 1995, directed by Michael Mann, with a running time of 166 minutes, an armed robbery crew knocks over an armored car, and events spring forth that bring the crew's leader into direct conflict with the head of Los Angeles's Robbery Homicide Division. As they plan their next big score, a chess game between the two men plays out as the thief looks to make one last big score, tying up loose ends in the process and outwit the cop who is hell-bent on taking them all down before it can happen. All right, guys, Heat.
Man, I'm sorry, Stevie. I screwed up. I watched Dead Heat with Joe Piscopo.
That's a whole different thing.
Oh, man.
Wait a minute.
I also watched.
In the Heat of the Night. What's going on? We got to do better with this communication.
Film, not so much.
Yeah. Wait, and then I watched Red Heat.
I was just going to say, what about Red Heat?
Yeah. I can go to White Heat, but I know we want to talk about
movies. White Light, White Heat. Yeah, I mean, listen, we could do a show just on movies with heat in the title.
We could, but we're doing Heat this week. So
yes, Michael Mann's action crime classic.
What a film.
And it is a classic. I have several pages of notes and bits and pieces of info about this. So I'll jump off with, so our leads in this film are Robert De Niro and Al Pacino, who very famously, when this movie was released, had never actually been in the same scene together in a film. They clearly had been together in a film, Godfather 2, very well known, very famous. However, but because of the fact that their timelines were about 80-some years apart, they never actually worked together. They were the initial choices for the two main characters. Robert De Niro was actually the first person to see the script for the film that Michael Mann had. And he's the one who showed it to Pacino, who replied, "We have to do this." Some funny other combinations that were considered as quote-unquote backups in case the two main guys' schedules would not work out. Mel Gibson and Harrison Ford.
Oh, wow.
And Nick Nolte and Jeff Bridges.
Wow.
I can see that better than the other one.
Huh.
Yeah, that's a whole different thing there. The idea of the alternate casting news was, and I love that stuff. I love hearing about the people who passed up on stuff. Yeah. Or didn't get to do something because of some, conflict with another project. I love hearing about stuff like that. I love hearing about other people who were considered for a role or didn't get it. And then you go back and you look at it. And so many times, especially in a movie like this, you're just like, you can't even imagine someone else playing that part.
No, not at all.
So an interesting thing about this movie. Did you guys know this was a remake?
I did not.
Neither did I, no. Wow.
Michael Mann made this movie himself in 1989 as a made-for-TV movie called L.A. Takedown. So during press for The Keep in 1983, he happened to mention that he had a script called Heat that was done that he was going to produce and not direct. He eventually stripped the 180-page script down to 110 pages, and he filmed a made-for-TV movie called L.A. Takedown to be used as a potential new series pilot. Essentially, the movie ends up being a trial run or a prototype of what Heat will be. Or at least, even though he didn't necessarily intend it at the time for that. Michael Mann himself has stated in an interview that comparing L.A. Takedown to Heat is like comparing freeze-dried coffee to Jamaican Blue Mountain beans. Now, if you're a coffee drinker, you get the idea, but it also works as, you know, comparing a Hyundai to a Cadillac. Right.
One's hardcore.
Or a Hyundai to a Ferrari.
One will get you where you want to go, and the other one is really riding.
I will tell you this. I watched it this morning because we watched Heat last night, and I watched LA Takedown this morning. And knowing that in the timeline of Michael Mann films, it comes after Manhunter, but before
Last
of the Mohicans, there is, when you watch it, it's hard to imagine that Michael Mann did it. Let's put it that way.
Wow.
It is so bad.
Oh,
it's bizarre. Latham, imagine this. Imagine you were tasked with taking a movie. Well, let's say something like The Godfather. I want you to make The Godfather, but I want you to make an hour and 15 minute long version of The Godfather using whoever you can get for $1 million.
Yeah. So with much less money.
Much less money.
And it can't be creative.
An hour less story. You know, it's all TV guys who you'll probably recognize if and when you see it. The guys from the era. There's a few name changes, obviously, because, you know, it's bizarre because you watch it and it's like you're watching this weird stripped down version of Heat, because you're like, I mean, there's literally pages of dialogue that are exactly the same.
Wow.
But it's just other people doing them. It's the weirdest thing to watch.
Now I kind of have to see it, you know, considering how much I love
the other
version.
It will be a little painful. just be aware. But yeah, it was a bit strange, to say the least, watching this sort of pre-version of Heat done like a TV show. And even done after he had done Manhunter, which, well, Manhunter still maintains the feel or the physical sense of Miami Vice to me, but it still has the sensibility of a film. It doesn't seem like a TV show.
Well, his style is there too. His style is fully developed with Manhunter. So,
and this is why I don't understand how 3 years later he makes a TV movie that looks like he made it before Manhunter.
Now, did he direct it or he just produced it?
He directed it.
He directed it. Okay. Wow.
He directed it, and it's bad. It's shockingly difficult to watch.
Wow.
So, but anyway, I was stunned to find out that he had essentially done Heat twice. And I just think that that's a really interesting side note in and of itself.
He's not above going back. You know, he did it with Miami Vice. You know, he's not above going back to his old, you know, to wherever he was staying before to visit the old house again. You know,
it's funny you say that, because there's a line that's used in Heat by Dennis Haysbert. When Dennis Haysbert is sitting in the diner talking to his girlfriend, where he said, they haven't invented a time that I can't handle.
Yeah. Yeah. The circumstance after he was taking heat, crap from the, from the store.
That exact line in essentially that form, slight modifications notwithstanding to context and the
circumstances situation.
Yes.
Yeah.
Appears in five of his film productions.
That line.
They haven't invented a time that I can't handle.
Interesting.
All right. So that's his see you next Wednesday, right?
Yeah.
For anyone who doesn't know this, John Landis has See You Next Wednesday in every one of his movies.
Oh, wow.
in some form or version. The movie that they go to
like Sam Raimi's car.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The Buick.
The movie that what's his name goes to see I don't know names, so this is not going to be useful, but in the in American Werewolf in London, Norton goes to the movie theater to see Aiden, what's his name, and as a ghost to meet the dead people that he had killed throughout the movie. And then the title of the movie is See You Next Wednesday.
Oh, that's great.
And it just appears in every one of his productions, including Thriller.
Where is it in Trading Places?
Oh, my God. I don't know.
I'm just curious because I saw that probably a month ago. I'm just trying to remember. I remember anyone saying
it's somewhere in there. It is somewhere in there. According to him, it's in every one of his
That's
movies.
Great.
Awesome.
So yeah, so after making LA Takedown, he then he shopped it to Walter Hill to direct. And Walter Hill turned the project down. No explanation.
Wasn't violent enough for him.
Yeah, probably. which is kind of funny too. So when he met up with his eventual producing partner Art Linson on the film to say, "Hey, do you want to produce this with me?" Art had told him that, "Sure, I'd love to." He goes, "But you have to direct this." He's like, "This isn't a story you can put in someone else's hands. You need to do this." It's interesting because the origin of the story is based completely in reality. The origin story behind this is an ex-Chicago police detective and friend of Michael Mann, a guy named Chuck Adamson, had told him a story of bumping into this career thief in Chicago named Neil McCauley at a dry cleaner's. And they ended up going to a nearby deli and having coffee and having this conversation and talking very similarly the way that the De Niro and Pacino characters talk about, "Hey, listen, you know, the line of business you're in, you know, there's a good chance that we're going to cross paths and, you know, I may have to put you down." And he's like, "Well, yeah, but what happens if you're in my way?" And there's a lot of parts of the Heat film that are drawn direct from actual events. It's actually kind of interesting. And then after the fact, there was a supermarket holdup that went awry, and Adamson's robbery team ended up being the first on scene, and his team is the one that shot and killed Neil McCauley during the robbery.
Wow, that's cool.
And as they say, which they prove wrong for this movie, that's stuff you can't write. You can't make that kind of stuff up.
Yeah, right.
Of course they did, but
yes, they did.
That's a great story, though.
So then Keanu Reeves was originally cast as Chris Chehalis. Wow. Because Val Kilmer was about to start shooting Batman Forever, and he could not get out of it.
Yeah.
So then it came back, and they were able to kind of what's that?
He phoned in his Batman performance so that he could.
Well, you know, he.
I'm kidding. I'm just kidding.
Yes. No, you know, whatever it is.
He faxed it in.
Faxed it in back then.
It was a bat fax. I'm sorry.
So they was able to work out the scheduling. So Keanu was released, and they kept Val. So the two films were actually shot during the same time frame. Some other people considered for the role of Chris Chehalis. Johnny Depp was actually offered the role first.
Oh, that would have been interesting.
But he wanted too much money at the time. He was too expensive at the time.
Yeah, and he was also according to Johnny Depp's own attitude about himself, especially in the commentary for From Hell.
Yeah,
when they offered him the role, he himself felt he was kind of box office poison. So the first thing he asked the Hughes brothers when they asked him for the role, he goes, "Have you guys squared this with the studio yet?" Because, you know, this was, of course, before Jack Sparrow and,
yes,
you know, his skyrocket. And he just figured that they offered him the job and that they were going to call him in about 2 weeks' time and tell him some kind of BS.
Jeez, we're really sorry.
Yeah, exactly. So even he at the time knew that he wasn't he wasn't always a viable choice for some movies like this.
Right. And then two other names apparently bandied about were Jean Reno and Brad Pitt.
Brad Pitt would have worked. As a Chehalis? Yeah, that would have.
Yeah.
That could have worked. That's basically who Val Kilmer was in the 80s. He was the Brad Pitt of the 80s.
Yeah, Jean Reno, not so much.
Yes. Yeah, I agree. So then we get into Michael Cerito.
Hmm.
And so this is interesting. So Michael Madsen was cast as Michael Cerito. Oh, well. And then right before shooting started, he was replaced with Tom Sizemore without explanation.
Hmm.
So I had actually some notes on my notes, because earlier in the week I had reached out to Michael Mann on Twitter just to see how one would get in touch with him to see if he'd be interested in joining us on this podcast. But, you know, he must have not checked his Twitter account. He's active on Twitter, but I doubt he's probably on it a lot.
Right.
But, you know, hey, nothing ventured, nothing gained.
Of course not.
But so one of my questions for him would have been, hey, what the hell happened with Michael Madsen?
Nope, nope.
Also considered for the Michael Cerito role was Don Johnson, who is apparently also on tap, technically, to be a backup for the two lead, either of the two lead roles, if something were to fall through.
Man, talk about the time that this movie was made, you know, that these people were
on
the roster for an A-list kind of movie.
And listen, Don Johnson gets a bad rep, but Don Johnson's an excellent actor.
One of my favorite movies of all times is Dead Bang. If you have not seen it,
love Dead Bang.
It's fantastic. And he's fantastic in it. So,
yep.
I have no argument with you on that.
William Peterson turned down the role.
Huh. Yeah. 95, wow. 90, what is it, 94, 95? So, yeah, we're talking probably a negotiation 95. Stage around 93. What was he?
Yeah, 93.
He was pretty big back then. He was pretty big around that time. So, I could see him kind of being.
Peterson was?
Yeah.
When did CSI start?
Not until 99 or 2000, 2000.
Okay.
But he was in back and forth. He did movies like he was Young Guns 2 and a couple of other movies. Like he was active. He was making movies.
Yeah, he was definitely he definitely didn't have a shortage of roles.
But the other thing with William Peterson is he was much more into stage acting than film and TV acting. I really kind of felt that he was doing movies and TV to pay for his stage acting stuff and help support, because he ran a theater in Chicago for a long, long time. You know, much in the way that, you know, De Niro used to take all those jobs in the 90s and the early 2000s to pay for all his, you know, personal film projects and Tribeca Films and all that. I just think that he was using it as a means to an end. I don't think that he was ever really about, you know, film and TV all that much. I think he much preferred the stage.
Makes sense.
So Nate, the criminal expediter, played by John Voight in the movie, based upon a real life criminal named Eddie Bunker, also considered for the role. And we'll come back to Eddie Bunker because it's actually kind of a funny story. Also considered for that role, Kris Kristofferson and briefly James Caan.
Oh.
Who later apparently during on the commentary track with Michael Mann for Thief lamented that he was not used in Heat in some capacity. that Michael was not able to get him in there. It's like, damn it, man.
I could see Conway. That would have been completely different. That would have been a different dynamic with him and and De Niro. But that would have been pretty crazy.
Sure.
Kris Kristofferson is almost John Voight. You know, he would have, that's almost, yes. That would have been the same energy, you know? So.
I agree.
Might be the same dude.
Have you ever seen them in a movie together?
Well, they weren't in Millennium together. That's
funny. A funny aside with LA Takedown, the guy who plays the Nate character in LA Takedown is the biker that Arnold throws onto the grill at the beginning of Terminator 2.
Oh, wow.
That's really cool.
Imagine that being the biggest thing you ever did.
Right?
And still bigger than anything I ever did, so I can't really mock it.
The Terminator threw me.
Yes, and I'm proud of it.
Natalie Portman's second film role following The Professional.
Professional, wow. Okay, yeah. Yeah, she was that young.
Yeah.
I forget she's in that movie, damn.
Yeah. So Danny Trejo and Eddie Bunker were actually hired by Michael Mann as consultants, as they had both previously done time for armed robbery and were considered pros in their field as consultants. And Danny Trejo used to do this a lot more when he was, you know, just out of prison and younger in Hollywood. Besides about all of his myriad of thug roles, he was also being used as a consultant for films of this nature. He then, Michael Mann was so impressed with him that he ended up earning the role of Trejo. In the film. And, you know, didn't have to worry about learning a new name.
How fortunate is that? What are the chances?
Yeah. Hey, can you just call me Dan once in a while? But what's so funny is, so Eddie Bunker is this guy who was hired as the consultant who the Nate character was based on. He's Mr. Blue in Reservoir Dogs.
Okay. Oh, man.
Interesting.
It was, you know, he's one of the two guys, him and Tarantino, who you only see after the heist.
Yeah.
Yes. You only see them at the table.
Mm.
But I thought that was a great bit that these guys got brought in as technical consultants. And you know, and something else I discovered about this, you know, a lot is made of John Wayne and his 200 film credits being this sort of pinnacle. I know Sam Jackson is over 200 now.
Oh, man.
Because he is very much along the same. He's much along the lines. He takes a lot of little roles and shows up in a lot of stuff.
Yes, he does.
Danny Trejo is currently sitting at 404 acting credits on IMDb. Wow. Now, if you consider the fact that he spent a good portion of his early life in prison and didn't even start acting until he was probably in either his 30s or his 40s, I mean, just think about that. And I just took a random year and just kind of counted them up. So in 2010, he actually had 30 acting credits just in 2010.
That's
Jesus Christ.
That is a guy who keeps busy.
Yeah, he knows where the which side of the bread his butter's on, though, you know.
He
made that lucrative for him. You know, small roles be damned. Someone's paying me, you know, and I'm on the up and up.
And clearly there was no shortage of people who wanted, you know, I mean, listen, I back in the 70s and 80s, there was a handful of guys who you just saw show up in every action movie, and they were always thugs.
Yeah.
Al Leong.
from Die Hard.
Brian James.
Yep, for sure.
There's just, you know, there's these guys, you know, I actually wrote a concept pitch for a mini series called Henchmen, where it's the story of a kid who is trying to become a henchman. And there's like a henchman's union, and there's a bar that all the henchmen hang out in. And like, you go there, and up on the walls are all these, like, you know, it's like the Cats or the Carnegie Deli. It's all these 8x10 black and white photos of famous old, like, movie and TV henchman actors.
Right.
And those, the headshots would be all on the walls, you know?
That's pretty good,
Steve. I just thought that was, you know, and then I later found out that there was actually a comic book series called Henchmen, and I just sort of, like, stepped away from it. But anyway.
Just change the name.
I know, but it just kind of writes its, I got to play around with hench.
Yeah. That's happened to me 100 times.
Right? Or maybe I do henchwoman and make it about a girl who wants to be a henchman. Then I fit
gender
right
swap.
In with the, I get fit in right with the state of things.
Yeah.
So this is all and another early appearance by an actor. This is the third film role for Henry Rollins, who played Hugh Benny, following The Chase and Johnny Mnemonic. There are certain actors who I just like to track their growth in films, and Henry is definitely one of them.
Good man. His philosophical stand-up is bar none. You know?
Yes.
Fantastic.
So, by the way, he has a podcast also that he does super infrequently, and now I don't think he's put an episode up for a little over a year, but he's got about 20 episodes up. And they go for anywhere from an hour to an hour and a half. And basically his assistant / manager starts off a show with him, and she just gives him a topic.
He just goes.
It ends, you know, it becomes like almost like a spoken word bit. You know, he just talks about it. But he's got some really great stuff up there that I've never heard on any of his spoken word recordings. So some good content there. That's a lot of fun if you like that kind of thing.
Yeah.
So another fun thing about this movie, the existence of a bunch of serial killers in other roles. So Ted Levine, Bosco, who is Vincent Hanna's number two, was Buffalo Bill in Silence of the Lambs.
Yes, he was.
Which was the sequel to Manhunter, which featured the killer Francis Dolarhyde, who is Tom Noonan, who played Kelso, who ended up giving the bank job to Robert De Niro.
And William Peterson. Wasn't William Peterson in Manhunter?
Yes.
So it just all comes strangely wrapped. But
Tom Noonan was in.
Yeah.
Right. But I mean, yeah.
Yeah. The continuity of Hannibal. But.
And then I found out later, and I didn't know this because I haven't watched Hannibal, but apparently the woman who played the mother of the hooker, who they find dead in the trash can, was a serial killer on Hannibal. Mm. In one of the episodes of Hannibal.
So the woman, the mother, yeah. Okay.
Yeah, the mother. Very strange. So Kevin Gage, who plays Wayne Grow, apparently did a 2-year prison stint in 2003, and most of the guards and inmates generally referred to him as Wayne Grow while he was there.
Huh. What was he in for?
His name
I don't know.
Has become a verb. between myself and Raheem, who's a friend of my Latham that that Steve knows. And every time, every time someone throws a monkey wrench into some kind of well laid plan, he pulled a Wangro.
Oh, that's funny. That's excellent.
He went to Wangro went or he went. Kevin Gage went to prison for growing marijuana.
Oh,
did he really?
Because I was gonna say, I'm like, he's a pretty scary bad guy. Right? And I was trying to picture. Well, he finally decided to be a real bad guy and hurt somebody, but no, it was just he was making medical marijuana.
Well, what's great about him, and we'll probably get deeper into this, but what's great about him is he's a menacing bad guy to people who aren't bad. When he came up against guys who were really bad guys, he was really no match for those guys, you know, such as Macaulay and, Michael, what's his name? I'm bad with names. I shouldn't be on a podcast. I'm so bad with names. But I mean,
self-fail.
I mean, look how easily they manhandled him in that movie, you know?
Yeah.
And he ran away, you know? So, but then the scene with the girl in the hotel room.
That was
terrifying for it, for you to put yourself in the place of that character. And he did a good job. Yeah,
that scene in the TV film is handled in an entirely different way. And the girl is presented as much less sweet. The way she's presented in the film.
Yeah, doe-eyed. She's less doe-eyed.
She kind of turns on him a little bit. It's like, get the fuck out of kind of thing. And he, not excusing his behavior. No. I'm just saying that he then, some of the dialogue that she actually has, then he then takes and says from his side in L.A. Takedown, which becomes even weirder. But that's...
Man, I gotta see this. I gotta see this film.
So the entire film was shot on 65 locations. There was absolutely no soundstage work whatsoever in this film. During the, the main gun battle, the shootout, and this was something I was curious to find out about, because one of the things that I maintain about that scene ever since I saw it the first time was that scene sounds like no other shootout you ever hear in a movie, really.
Correct.
The reason for that being is he actually mic'd the entire street in sort of strategic locations based on where guys would be. And when they got into the editing process, he ended up loving the sound of the live fire so much more than the overdubs. He ended up not using any audio overdubs for the gunfire whatsoever. So all of the gunfire you hear is live, which is why you get all those great echoes off of the buildings.
It just sounds terrifying. It sounds so terrifying.
It is. It is. And it's that scene plays like no other shootout from any film because of that. I think that, you can add those loud TV gunfire sounds that we've heard for 50 years in films. I think he did the same thing really in the shootout at the end of Miami Vice, the movie. I think that he probably did it the same way, because I felt
he said he wanted that to counter. He wanted that to be a good companion piece with the Heat shootout.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that makes sense, because I did definitely feel like the two were very similarly, not the layout of the shootout, but definitely the sound for sure.
And if you watch Miami Vice with the commentary, he actually describes like them pulling an L pattern on the, so they could cross triangulate Ortiz and the rest of his guys.
Yeah.
You know, he gets really intricate in that commentary about exactly what each of the Miami-Dade cops are doing to try to counterbalance it.
Yeah.
Pretty fascinating.
He had two ex-British SAS guys as his technical consultants for the sort of both the firearms handling and for the military operational part of things. You sort of witness during this whole sequence with Neil and Chris especially.
Right.
Something they don't go into, and clearly Chris has some sort of training, because obviously his specialty is the explosive side of things. So clearly there's something there. But one of the things they go into, they don't mention it specifically, but you sort of tacitly get it if you're paying attention. In the scene where Nate is telling Neil about Vincent by, looking at his file and whatnot, he mentions that Vincent was in the Marine Corps.
Yeah.
So earlier in the film, if you're watching, when Neil McCauley gets up out of bed from the first night he spends over at Edie's house, when he's getting up, he has a Marine Corps tattoo on his shoulder.
Uh-huh.
So these guys were both Marines.
Yeah.
Which is kind of,
and because Macaulay does a better job being a non-entity, there's less information on exactly who and what he is.
Sure.
You know, as opposed to Chehalis, who is, you know, kind of a little more reckless and probably would be leaving.
Right.
Probably would leave. His off the grid is probably a little more haphazard than Macaulay's. You know, Macaulay's is almost like,
absolutely.
You know, it's almost, it's a methodical, whereas Chris is, it's more of a, you know, is more energetic, kind of astatic kind of thing. So there'd probably be a bigger file on Chris than Macaulay, you know?
100%. I don't know that Chris would really ever be off the grid.
Yeah.
Other than going, you know, his off the grid is going to be going to a country with no extradition. That's about as off the grid as he's going to get.
Right.
You know, because he's still got a lifestyle that clearly he likes living. And
yeah.
Each take of the shootout used between 800 and 1,000 rounds of ammunition. I don't know how many takes they did, but that's a lot of brass on the ground. Moving on to the diner sequence.
There's one thing that's supposedly an urban legend, and I just didn't know if, you know, I waited to see if you had it, you know, so I wouldn't step on what you were saying.
Yeah.
There's an urban legend of an army sergeant who uses that film roll for his troops. And he said, if you can't service and reload your weapon faster than this actor, and he's talking about Val Kilmer, he said, you don't belong in this army.
I have that coming up in a little bit, my friend.
Darn, I didn't mean
that. That's okay. No. That's absolutely fine. But there's more to it than that. But yes, I actually have that later on.
Yeah, of course.
So there were no rehearsals for the diner scene, as De Niro felt that it would help promote the lack of familiarity between the two guys if they didn't go through it beforehand.
Well, let's do it. Let's just sit down and do it.
And I'll tell you, man, it's, you know, watching this movie, it's funny. It's like when the movie ended last night, it's one of those things where when you haven't seen a movie that you remember loving and you haven't seen it for a while, even if it's like only like 10 years, I think 10 years is a long time, but in the grand scheme, 10 years isn't that much. When you sat down and you watch it again and it still is so good that you just, it's like you hate when it ends almost, you know, because even if the ending like in that film is just so perfect.
Yeah. There's some films that are so full of life and energy and whatever, that there is no way that if they have satisfying endings, even if they have a satisfying ending.
Right. It's like, you just want more of it. It's just, it's so successful. Yeah. And I feel like Heat is definitely one of those movies.
My favorite, but when I'm like, goddamn, I can't. I'm trying not to gush about the film. I love the scene just before that scene where he just, you know, he pulls Macaulay over.
Yeah.
And the way it's shot, where he just kind of comes out of the shadows and he's got the strobe, you know, he's got the police lights on him, you know, and he comes into prominence and he goes, hi, you know, let's say you and I get a cup of coffee, you know, and it's not.
I think it's funny because they, you know, he pulls him over and he takes the gun and he puts it down next to him,
mm-hmm.
you know, between the seat and the console. And then Pacino's walking up and he's got his gun drawn hanging behind him.
Yeah.
He's like, hey. And he's just like, hey.
Yeah, why don't we just.
What do you say we get some coffee?
We know who we are. Why don't we just talk? Yeah, right?
Yes.
It's just so great. And it's also because you'd just been given quite a significant glimpse into Hannah's, you know, terrible home life, you know, like the
right.
So this is almost his recreation. Like, he's doing this recreationally.
And that's a big part of the story, is the fact that, you know, this is more his life than his life is.
Okay, go ahead.
Well, I think that's, I was going to say, that's a common thread with all the characters in the movie, is they all are betrayed by their own. They all have a duty to what they're good at, but they're betrayed by their emotions in how they handle their personal life. And they show, I mean, he takes a lot of time, Michael Mann does, in showing these relationships degrade or fall off the map.
Yeah.
You know, a little bit at the end where Pacino comes back to his, well, not even so, because Pacino, is that his wife or his girlfriend?
I think it's his marriage. They're married.
They're married.
They are married. Because he said he's on the downslope of another, his third marriage.
Yes.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. And he basically just admits to her, I am who I am, and you shouldn't be with me. And she like agrees with them, and she's like, you got to go finish the conclusion of the story.
Yeah, you got to finish the movie.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that's a common thread that rolls through the whole movie.
Yeah, they're all bad at being normal. You know, they're all bad at being standard people, you know?
Right. Yeah. As De Niro, as you know, as Neil says, what's a regular life? Baseball and barbecue?
Yeah. Yeah. I can't do that kind of life. And then what I like, the great thing about that scene is that the both of them are searching each other. So even Macaulay, who's kind of, he's usually closed off. He's almost pathologically closed off throughout the film. He does have questions for Hannah. He goes, well, you know, if you got to be on me whenever I move, how the hell are you going to keep a life? I think if you think about it next to Chris and Macaulay have such a shorthand that they hardly even speak throughout the film.
Right.
So I think Hannah is the first person that Macaulay can open up to at all, other than the character that John Voight is playing, right?
Yeah, but that's a business thing though, more than anything
exactly.
Else. You know, and Neil so understands Macaulay, that.
Yeah, Macaulay's kind of shield come down because even with Edie, he's still kind of closed off.
Oh,
he's still locked 100%. Up. So it's just really well done.
Xander Berkeley, who plays Ralph that Diane Venora sleeps with, played Wayne Grow in the TV film. So he is the only actor who is in both productions.
You cannot.
He is also on the greatest.
You cannot use my television set.
Yes, you can ball my wife. If she wants you to.
But you do not get to watch my television set. Sorry, Latham. What were you going to say?
I had a pop culture moment about Xander Berkeley. He's in the single greatest episode of the TV show 24 with Kiefer Sutherland. Either of you guys watch
it? Which season? I've seen the first two.
I think it's the second or third one. He basically, Kiefer Sutherland, he's told by the terrorist, Kiefer Sutherland is told that he has to kill him by the end of the hour. And the whole hour, they try and figure out a way to not kill him, Xander Berkeley. And then time runs out and he fucking kills him. And it's a brilliant, brilliant
spoiler alert.
Episode of a show that became subpar.
For what? A show that what?
That became subpar. The show was an interesting idea. I think it got weaker as the seasons went along. But I remember...
How many seasons did they do? Five?
You couldn't keep something like that up.
Five, six, or seven. I'm not sure. No, you really can't, Hassan. It's a gimmick. But that episode was played to the gimmick. They knew they had an hour to save this guy, and he couldn't outwit the terrorist, and then something horrible was going to happen if he didn't kill him. And he has to shoot him dead. And it's just it's kind of like a Black Mirror episode. It's just really, really raw, but it's great. It's really well done. I think it's the best episode of that series. That's why I remember him as an actor, is because of that episode. Otherwise, I wouldn't.
One of the many people who list this film as being on their favorite lists, Christopher Nolan loves this film.
It feels like a Nolan film at times.
He actually mentions in several interviews that he actually used Mann's interpretation of Los Angeles as his inspiration for Gotham City for the Batman films.
Uh-huh.
He felt that was the Gotham City with L.A. in Michael Mann's Heat was the Gotham City he wanted.
He's got a lot of love letters to L.A. Michael Mann loves.
Oh, absolutely.
LA. Especially in Collateral. I think that's his biggest love note to at Los Angeles. He definitely likes his geography. He loves the character of whatever setting that he's
in. It becomes a character in the film. Mm-hmm. A whole separate part. It's not just a setting. So Ben Affleck, while he was doing research for his film The Town, which is another excellent heist film all in itself, has discussed publicly that when he was doing research interviews with prison inmates for, you know, robbery crews, and also with members of the FBI, that both groups referred to the movie Heat in his interviews with them, which just stands to reinforce the level of respect that is held for this by both law enforcement and the criminal side of things, as to the veracity of what kind of shows on the film.
Yeah. I think that something that makes a movie like this in particular so substantial in the minds of other people is that there's really nothing uniquely new or interesting about the film in and of itself. It is one of those kind of almost run-of-the-mill, routine, play bad games, win bad prizes kind of circumstances where everybody does one or two, just like Latham said, everybody does one or two things against their own nature, against their routine nature. They can't help it for whatever reason. They give in to impulses and they mess themselves up. And everybody gets messed up at the end of it. I mean, nobody gets out of it. Nobody, and it's not unique. You know Macaulay is going to do what he does at the end that drives you crazy. You know that Chris is going to, you know that Treo is going to betray. I mean, you know all these things. Nobody surprises you. But the characters are done so well. And the setting, the film is put together so well. The story is rolled out so well. The production is, everything else is so top-notch that you are so enthralled in the story that even 100 times after, having seen it for the first time, I'm still screaming at Macaulay not to get off the highway, or towards the end of the film. Like, you're almost out. You got it. You got the girl. You got money. I'm screaming for them to be, even though they're the criminals, I'm screaming for them all to be able to get in the car and drive away before Hannah shows up. There is nothing unique about any of that stuff, but it's so well done. You don't care that you've seen it. You know the language. You just don't care. You're 100% locked in with those characters. And that is probably the hardest thing to do with movies and with stories in general, is everybody thinks it's telling a unique story, a very interesting story, but really it's just character. And writing character is very hard. So whenever you get a movie like this with excellent characters in it, people start to study it, over and over and over again, and it becomes a favorite. That's, that's my opinion, but I think that's what does it for this film. I've seen 150,000 films where the hero, is just about to win, whatever objective he's after, and makes that last reach for the donut or whatever he's going to do that totally messes him up and turns a movie, turns a victory into a defeat. And we've seen it a billion times. And when it's really well done, we're heartbroken by it. And when it's poorly done, we're like, oh, here we go. this guy's gonna F himself up. I mean, I won't get into that just in case no one else has seen it. But I mean, I have an example of that exact same scenario being done very poorly. And it was infuriating. All you are is just pissed off. Like, come on, guy, you're trying to sell us this story. You're trying to tell me that this idiot is gonna make this mistake at this hour. At this moment in the story, this is ridiculous. I don't buy it at all. And then you get a movie like Heat where you buy every minute of it.
I think the reason you buy it are those quiet scenes about their failings in their relationships. There's so many of them in this movie, and every one of them adds to their character. And then when they make those mistakes, instead of you saying, oh, what an idiot, why is he doing that? You remember that you saw them act earlier in the story towards that nature. So yeah. Then you're like, oh yeah, they were going to do that, but maybe they can get away with it. I'm kind of rooting for them to get away with it. And then you're, in almost all cases, save for one, you find out that they don't get away with it. That's what makes it a unique film, I think.
Yeah. Watching a bunch of Michael Mann films in a row today, something I discovered is that I think that when you look at Heat versus a number of his films, especially Miami Vice, it feels like he's following a certain formula to an extent. There are certain things, and he didn't write all those screenplays, so it's not necessarily that he's creating all the story involved. But I feel like that there are certain things that he goes out of his way to have in the film because they worked in Heat. And I feel like that it's not necessarily him trying to just, recreate that magic, but there are certain things I think he feels are important to building a particular character, or a character into a character. And I feel like that's the only way he knows how to get that sort of thing into that character's identity. So you see a pattern start to show up when you watch a bunch of his movies in a row. And I think it's really come,
which I've never done, by the way. I don't
and I think it really comes back to the success of Heat and how good of a It's one of those movies that it's a perfect storm movie. There's nobody in that film that you ever don't believe in any of the roles. Mm-hmm. There is no point when you're watching the movie that you're suddenly like tapping your watch saying, oh, how much time is left? There's no point, you know, even though it's got very, you know, as Latham pointed out, it's got very high volume moments and low volume moments, but it's just kind of timed and spaced out so well and handled so deftly that you never get bored with it. Everything is there for a reason. And you don't go into that movie looking like, did they really need that scene? Did that really need to happen?
Yeah.
I almost wish that in a movie like this, that there was a 4-hour cut somewhere that, you know, exists because, you know, wouldn't it be nice to have more, you know? And that's just, you know, it's like, well, when I was talking about watching that bootleg cut of Almost Famous last week, that's, in, you know, that's 40 minutes longer than the original. And I told you that it's really just about giving you more of all the characters in the film. And it really is.
Right.
That's the kind of director's cut I'd like to see for Heat, if it ever were to exist. I know they've done a director's cut of it, but it was really more about shifting some things around. And the actual time of the film doesn't really change all that much.
Yeah, I think the director's cut has become the standard cut. Like that you see on all social media, like
he did, like he's done this a couple of times. He did it with Last of the Mohicans as well, where he's gone back and done like his definitive director's film edition of that film. You know,
terrible.
What's that?
It's terrible too.
What's terrible?
He Last of the Mohicans because he lost the license when he redid it. He lost the license on some of the music, so it's not terrible. Excuse me. Let me rephrase that. If you're used to the original movie, if you're used to the original cut, there are sequences where there are certain music cues and there are beats and stuff like that. And there is a song called No Matter Where You Go, I'll Find You.
Yeah.
That coincides with him saying that to Madeline Stowe, No Matter Where You Go.
In the waterfall.
And then, in the director's cut of it, they don't have the license to that song anymore. So they don't play it at that montage where they're chasing the Hurons. To whatever the new camping is. And they don't have it. It is almost like Michael Mann's pissed off that they don't have it. So you just see the montage with no musical cue and just a whole bunch of superimposed grunts and groans of the three main characters as they cut they're cutting their way through the forest and twigs are smacking them in the face and stuff like that. And you're like, this is, and it goes on. It goes on naturally, and then it seems like it loops again. So to the point where you almost see the same scenes again, and you're like, this is terrible. The rest of the movie is great, because the rest of the movie has sequences and scenes that are not in the theatrical cut. But it's such a trade-off. It's such a poor trade-off, you know, right. if you are a fan of the original cut of the movie. And that's a sidebar.
So I have two last little bits. Apparently, during filming, Danny Trejo is quoted as saying Val Kilmer told him during shooting that Warners had offered him $40 million for a follow-up to Batman Forever, and Val Kilmer said no. So we would not have had the George Clooney Batman if Val Kilmer had just said yes.
Jeez, he must have hated.
Yeah, I'm sure that he was not.
$40 million.
Right? So when this film finally came to network television, Michael Mann disavowed the NBC edit of the film. They, and this is just so typical of television in the 90s. So they gave it a 3-hour time slot, but it's an almost 3-hour movie. So they literally cut.
They cut
40 minutes out of it.
Oh boy! Well, 250, right?
And they cut 40 minutes out of it in order to fit it into the 3-hour time slot with all the commercials.
They bastardized
it. He basically told them, remove my name from the credits as director.
Put Alan Smithy.
Well, he told them that they could use either Michael Smithy.
Oh, great.
Or Alan Mann.
Oh, it's fucking great. That's
he said they could use either one.
Yeah, that's brilliant. Awesome.
I have no idea which or if they did, but I kind of want to try and go find.
Well, you found LA Takedown. You can find that.
Yeah, you definitely you'll be able to excavate that from somewhere.
It's in the same ditch as all the ET cassettes, Atari video game or whatever in the Arizona desert.
Have you watched that documentary, Lay?
I have not. How's that for a pop culture tangent?
Yep. So, I'm sorry, I skipped over it, but back to your urban legend, Hassan. So,
yeah, what's the full skinny on that one?
Val Kilmer was actually very delighted to hear U.S. Marine recruits at the station in San Diego are regularly shown footage of that you spoke about with Val Kilmer running out, dropping the mag and reloading the mag while under fire as a perfect example of how to do that under fire. And apparently they use not only that sequence, but they also use several other sequences during the shootout, or have used them for training purposes.
How they cover each other.
Yeah. So that's all I have, guys. Anything you guys have?
I got a bunch. Yeah. I got a bunch of little pop culture things here. I don't want to rain on this parade because I do like this movie a lot. I gave it 3.5 stars, and I maintain that out of 4. I know.
I gotta go, guys.
Ready to hit eject here on the Zoom eject feature. Goodbye, Lay.
I think I hear my mom calling me, and you have to be me to know how weird that is. So I got
you. That's even weird coming out of your mouth.
So I wrote in my mini review, I wrote Shortcuts cop movie. If you've seen Shortcuts by Robert Altman, that's what I, when I first saw it, that's what I thought of it.
Interesting.
And then I put, it only needed a better ending. Now I read that before watching it again. And while I was watching it, I saw it in the theater with Stevie. Did you know we saw this together?
I wouldn't have remembered that, but it makes sense.
So it came out in December of 95. I remembered most of the movie, but when it got towards the ending, I was having trouble remembering who was going to win here, or if they both were going to die or whatever. I couldn't remember it.
Good.
And that last scene, I'm not sure what the inherent flaw in it is. I think it's when they're finally out on the airplane, wherever that is, the field, and the planes are coming in. I think I have a problem with the logistics with the lights. And when the final lights come on and you can see him, I don't know, that bothered me, and I thought maybe it could be a little better. And again, I don't want to rain on the parade for this movie because I think it's a great film. That was one thing that just bothered me in a minor way. And then the other one thing that bothered me more was Natalie Portman's first scene in the movie, I think glaringly stands out as like the only fail of acting in the film. I think it's really cardboardish and seems to not work. And I think she has what, 3 scenes in the movie? Am I right? Total, if you count the scene where she's dead.
Yeah, not that many. Not many at all. So 3 scenes
not terrible. It's just
You're talking about the scene where she has the panic attack because she can't find her barrettes?
Yeah, and it's not so much even the end of that scene with her mom. It's before that. It just seems very like, oh, she was awesome in The Professional. Let's throw her in this and give her a few scenes. And her death scene is great.
Didn't die.
She didn't die. You're right. Attempted suicide scene, which I thought was unique too, how they portrayed it. And she played that well. And then the scene where she gets in the car, she's good. But the first scene, it stuck out with me and it bothered me. It bothered me enough to where I wrote it down while I was watching it. So, but otherwise, a great film. No one should miss it. Other little bits. Obviously, the cast is ridiculous, and Steve has touched on it with all his stories. But there's just, I mean, is that David Paymer at the beginning of this film in one of the first scenes where he's?
I don't remember David Paymer.
No.
What's the role?
I'm trying to remember. It's like the first scene in the film. It's almost like a cameo, but I might be wrong, and I am wrong. So it's not him. It's the first guy you see at the beginning of the film.
Well, it opens with the bank heist or the armored car heist.
Right, the armored car heist. I wish I could remember what it was. But I thought I'm like, wow, he's in this too. Obviously I'm wrong at this point, but then if you go around through the rest of the film, I mean, there's just actor after actor after yes. actor throughout this. And it never ends. William Fichtner,
the great William Fichtner, one of my favorite character actors.
You know, Tone Loc pops up. I'm like, is that Tone Loc?
Yep.
That's not Tone Loc. And then you look at like, is. Yep, that's Tone Loc.
That's Tone Loc.
So that was cool. The amazing thing about this film, no Oscar nominations, not nope. one in any category, not sound editing, not supporting actor, not actor, nothing. It's just a crime that nothing in this film got nominated. I think what adds to the film is the score. The score is very minimalistic. Who is it? It's Elliot Goldenthal.
Yep.
Am I right? I mean, it's very minimalistic and it works. It just lets the movie breathe. And
then that end fades, I think.
No,
yeah, from Moby.
The end piece is God moving over the face of the waters.
Oh, right. Very good.
Oh, that's right.
New Dawn fades. Okay. New Dawn fades
is a completely different. That's the chase scene. New Dawn fades is a scene where he's chasing Macaulay and asked him to go for coffee. Okay. Excuse me.
Oh, that's it. So,
you're right.
And then the music felt very Manhunter-ish, but of course Manhunter was mostly artists and this was score. And I thought that was an interesting comparison. I love the loose end that Chris gets away and that's it. And you don't even find out what happened. I think that's what made it. I think that's one of the things that made it feel like Shortcuts to me. Like,
man, he didn't ruin it. Like Affleck ruins the town. Oh. Don't listen to the, do not listen to the commentary on the town.
Stevie, edit it out. Yeah. I haven't seen the town either.
Oh, really? Well,
you like the town.
I know. It's on my Netflix list. I haven't seen it.
Affleck, without giving anything away at all, because he directed it, so he would have the right to. He opines on what happens after the fade to black.
Oh, okay.
And it's like, why would you do that? You know, like don't tell us what you believe happened next. Like, just leave it there.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Yeah. So at least Michael Mann didn't do that to us.
That's true. That's true. While you guys were talking, I mean, you're gonna, you know, we all have our movies that others can't believe we haven't seen. I've never seen Collateral, and I don't. I want to. Okay. I've wanted to for a long time, and
until today, I hadn't.
Oh, okay. Wow. Okay. Hassan obviously had seen it a long time ago.
Yeah, I saw it so long ago I forgot about it. I had to watch it again.
Wow, I really need to see it. If it's already left your memory, that's bad.
It's one of those movies where it's hard to believe that people are acting in it. Everything seems so natural.
Okay.
That you don't even feel like they're acting. You feel like you're just watching life happen.
I can't wait to watch this film now.
It's really good.
Yeah, it is.
And what a tremendous
ending, which is another subdued ending.
Yep.
Without giving anything away. His endings
skew that way in general.
Yeah. Okay. And it's like, once you see the ending, it's like, wow, this couldn't have really ended any other way. But while it's happening, you're like, you're completely in the dark about what will happen, how it will turn out.
It's simultaneously like, you're just like, well, that's what should have happened. I just didn't see it coming.
Yeah. I guess that's over.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, it's one of those.
That's like some life is done. last few things. I think it's funny watching the scenes with Robert De Niro and John Voight, knowing they would never be caught in the same room now if you paid them money.
Yeah.
They're at opposite ends of the life and political spectrum right now. So I found that to be interesting.
Yeah, totally.
And then also, last two things I wrote. This is the film where you really, for Michael Mann's style, you see him master this, I call it the slow zoom for emotional effect. These shots that just start far away and then slowly zoom in as the characters are talking. And I think it's his signature shot from his films. And I love it when he does it. And it always, you remember the ones from Manhunter, there's a bunch in there and there's a bunch in this movie and they all work, you know, make him the auteur that he is. I mean, how this didn't get a best cinematography nomination is just mind.
Yeah, that was one of, it's probably one of those weird political years where like they were,
well,
the Academy was, I saw a documentary on, and I will not go on a tangent on this. I saw a documentary on how the Academy chooses.
Oh yeah, it's garbage.
Going to win or not, and it's, yeah, it's complete. It has nothing to do with talent. It's garbage. It's almost like a lottery.
You're a Braveheart.
Yeah. Too, so. That's exactly. Braveheart swept that year.
Like, it won almost everything. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was pretty, and you know, it's a great movie. I think it's as good as this one or whatever. But I mean, there is some shots in this film. It's just. It deserved something and didn't get anything. And then my last point, and this is obviously probably fueled by what's going on in our society today, but I just noticed it and thought it was really cool. In Heat, there are all kinds of different races. There's white, there's black, there's a Native American character, everybody. And at no point in the film is at any point racism even brought up or thought of. And a lot of films recently, especially cop films, that's a big story point or whatever. In this, it's you're either a good guy with flaws or you're a bad guy with flaws. And you just think of everyone in this uniform nature.
And one, as I'm watching, one caveat, though, about because yes. Wayne Grow is covered in white nationalist tattoos.
Is he? Okay, I missed that. Then that's,
yeah, and it's implied that the murder is also, you know, now he's also a sociopath.
Yeah, killer. That's why he's a serial killer, yeah. They're saying too.
But it's implied that there, you know, there is an added connotation because the girl he killed is a black girl.
Okay. Well, that's a good point then. I missed the tattoos.
Yeah, but it's in no way, as you say, it is in no way a lingering point in the film. It's just an added, you know, we are supposed to hate Wayne Grow more than we hate everybody else in the film. He's the only villain in the piece next to Van Zandt, who is kind of on the other spectrum. Those are the two inauthentic characters in the story who are kind of one-dimensionalized. Correct. And they're like that for a reason. So that does not dispute anything that you've said, you know, about all the genuine characters, just to, you know, not to dispute you.
And the serial killer like thing or thrill killer, they kind of throw that in there with a line or two lines.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
And I thought that was kind of, I don't know. I understand, like, just like you said, they want to make him the worst guy in the film that you want to see get taken down.
Yeah.
But I don't know if they needed to even call him that. He was all, you know, he was a psychopath, as was shown in the bank robbery at the robbery scene at the beginning, armored car scene at the beginning of the film. So to put that in there, I think it just felt a little bit pushy.
If you think about it, that entire scene, that entire hotel room scene, which Steve has now told us is also in Shakedown, yeah. LA Takedown. That entire scene is kind of superfluous. We already know Wayne Grow is the bad guy. We already hate him. We already know Hannah's a cop. So we don't even need the adjoining scene afterwards where they find the mother finds her daughter in a, other than to see that he's in his genuine element.
Yeah, no, that's
controlling the scene.
It.
Yeah.
When he hugs her. Yeah, yeah. That's integral. That's why we have that scene, but we don't need the scene before it. You don't need the scene where he kills her in the hotel room or the lead in because you already know.
He's already evil. He's already, yeah, Darth Vader. We don't need to see him, you know, kill Obi-Wan Kenobi in order to hate
maybe
him.
Maybe they felt they needed to reinforce it. I don't know. But that scene stands out a little bit as, you know, not unnecessary, but that they were trying, they wanted you to hate that guy.
Going, yeah, they're hedging stuff. Their bets. They hedged, yeah, their bets on that one.
Yeah, there you go.
Interestingly, so, for LA Takedown, when it comes to the hotel room scene with the cops, Macaulay, who's got a different name in the movie, and Wayne Grow, outcome basically the same, but okay, how they get there, totally different.
Tell Hassan who plays Wayne Grow.
I did. Xander Berkeley.
Oh, I thought there was another famous guy in who does Michael Rooker play in that?
Michael Rooker plays.
Oh, he plays Bosco. He plays Bosco. Yeah, I saw that listing after you said, yeah, it. And I'm like, holy cow, how did he get involved in that?
So here's an interesting mirror. I don't know if you noticed. So the only cop that gets killed is
Bosco.
Al Pacino's, okay, number two guy. Bosco.
Mm-hmm. And you assume he does, but he's got that vest on. He's got blood around his neck. I mean, and
He got shot in the neck. His eyes are whited over, too. And the only guy from the robbery crew that makes it, that lives, is the number two guy.
See, this is for your henchman show. This is how you started. This is origin story, Stevie. That's how it starts.
That's how it starts. He survives.
That's all I got, unless Hassan's got anything else.
I just got glowing yays and wonderfuls and stuff like that. I think the only thing in that film that I don't buy, it always stands out to me.
Yeah.
The Tone Loke scene where he's about to get up and he goes, "This slick is not a joke." And that's what catches Hannah's ear. And I'm like, wow, that's a leap.
Really? That bothered you?
Yeah, because it's just such a leap. Because, oh, that's what he calls everybody, slick. And then that's kind of the catch that kind of ties the whole thing. Yeah.
That's how they get him.
The only thing that bothers me, because it's like, man, that seems like it sounded writerly. It sounded like a writing solution. You know, it didn't feel organic to me.
But you see, I think that I actually think it feels more natural than not, because that's the kind of throwaway detail that ends up tripping up people in those situations. It's the kind of thing, absolutely, somebody just makes a comment about something and they don't even realize that that's the piece of information that actually all this hinges on. Like, this guy goes through this whole process of telling him how he is feeling about the fact that this guy went out of his way to tell him that, mm-hmm, he had nothing going on, clearly meant that he did have something going on. And Pacino's like, who gives a fuck what you feel? You know?
Yeah.
And it wasn't until the fact that he makes a comment about the fact that this guy always calls people slick. He has no idea that that's going to be the thing that is going to catch Pacino's ear, because it happened to have come up because that one of the other guys heard him, mm-hmm, or heard him call the other guy slick, you know, because it was one of the only things the guy heard.
Right. Well, look, what I'm saying is not the detailing in of itself that Hannah catches and then it ties it together for Hannah. That wasn't my issue with it. My issue is the way it's staged, where just as Hannah's about to get up, Tone Loke uses the guy's words, slick, you know, and then that catches him. And then suddenly he's like, why'd you use the word slick? And he says, okay, that's what he calls everybody.
Yeah, I agree that it probably would have felt a little more natural had he not just gotten up to leave.
I don't know. In the middle of the scene, though, like in the middle of that conversation, yeah, it probably would have been more natural, but then you lose the effect of it, I think.
That's what I'm saying. It's the only thing in the film to me that feels like it was written for effect. Everything else is kind of like a roller coaster where it's like these guys are just trying their best to hold on while they're doing what they're doing, you know, because everything is falling apart in Hannah's life. Macaulay's starting to lose control of his tightly wound existence and stuff like that. So it's the only kind of like, and it's forgivable. It's completely forgivable. But if I had to call out any detail, that's the only thing I always end up tripping on, because it just feels like, how do I tie in slick? You know, how do I tie this all together? It's detail. Okay, I'll have Wayne Grove say slick, and then I'll have someone hear him say slick, and then someone will say that this guy says slick all the time, and that'll be how Hannah ties the whole thing together. And now I got to find a way to get that said in a sentence. And it just seems like, okay, I'll just have Tone Loke use it. And it's just the only thing that bugs me. It's very minute. It's nothing. But since we were just going over the film itself, because the rest of everything I have to say about this film is freaking glowing. It's an absolute love fest. And it's not even that scene. It's not a bad scene. First of all, Tone Loke is great in it. Al Pacino is fantastic at all times. You know, the funny caveat is that Al Pacino played the role as though he was, like, every scene he had just done a bump of coke before every scene started. So he played it like he was a cokehead, but that wasn't added into the actual mix of the film.
Well, actually, it is in the mix of the film. It's just not talked about in the film. In the script, it actually says that he has a coke issue.
No, okay.
Oh, that's interesting. That's
interesting that you may say that. another part, you know, like when he has that outburst with Hank Azaria in the office.
Great
where
ass.
Like, he's like, great ass.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So Azaria had no clue that he was going to do that.
So that Jesus Christ was real?
Yes. His reaction is 100% real. Because he had absolutely no clue that Pacino was going to do this. And that was the take that they used.
And you got your head stuck all the way up.
Your head's all the way up.
I want to add to Hassan's point, too, about that one little scene where he says slick. I think there's other examples of kind of what Steve was saying, that there's things in life that just happen, and they may seem in a movie situation or story like they're convoluted, but those kinds of things happen. And the two examples in the film are when they're staking their robbery out, and the fucking SWAT guy backs up into the side of the truck and makes the noise. And that's what blows their entire stake out there.
Yeah.
He just makes a simple little mistake and hits the side of the thing with his gun. And that guy's like all ready and he's like all focused, and he just hits the side of the truck, and that Robert De Niro pulls him out and says, nope, we got to go. And I thought that was a cool, like, common man moment mistake, because, you know, that leads to the next part of the story. And then the other one, and you guys tell me if I'm mistaken, when everything's going to shit at the hotel at the end of the movie, and Pacino finally gets there, the way it seems like he mentally makes the connection by seeing Amy Brenneman in the car, that why is that car parked by the dock, and why is she in the passenger seat, and who's coming to her?
That's his
girl.
How,
that's what I took out of it.
Yeah.
I took, like, he's making that connection. That's the girl he was referring to when they had their coffee talk. I don't know if that's how you're supposed to take it, but
I agree.
I never had a problem with those convolutions, you know.
The other one's like more, I said, it's just script thing.
It's just a dialogue thing. It's just like, I'll have it, because it's really weird to me that someone else's common phrase would be a phrase that you would end up using, you know, in a common term, instead of saying, if it's a detail so strong in your mind that you end up using it yourself, that would be part of your report, you know, if you were trying to sell information to someone else. So I understand that the scene was supposed to be, you ain't got nothing, you know, this is all incidental crap, I'm not interested. And then, how do I even know that what you're saying to me, you're not telling me a bag of goods? And then he says slick, and that locks him right in. How do I get Tone Loc to say he uses the word slick all the time? Because that is honestly, in writing, in real life, that is not something I would tell someone else. Like, if I was talking about Steve and I was describing him to you, the first thing I would say would not be, oh, he likes to say slick all the time. You know, that wouldn't be one of the details I would add.
That's a forced moment for sure.
Yeah. So that's really the only, and it's not even a problem.
It's not a bad one. You're noticing it.
To end my thoughts on Heat, it's kind of like the same with, it's one of those movies that keeps telling you exactly how, just like you were saying, Latham, it keeps telling you exactly what's going to happen. It keeps telling you that everything's going to go south. It keeps telling you all these guys are going to get effed over, and it's not going to work out. It's not going to work out for Hannah. It's not going to work out for Macaulay. Not going to work out for Wayne Grove or Van Zandt or any of these people. But
it only works out for Val Kilmer's character, because his wife or girlfriend is true to her nature.
Well, she stepped out of character just for that last moment, and she stepped up for him, because she was she's belittling him the whole movie about him not standing up for her. It's kind of like, and it's just one of those things where it just makes a great movie. It's just like Saving Private Ryan. The entire time in Saving Private Ryan, towards that last, they tell you, we are outnumbered. There is an entire division of tanks and soldiers, and they are coming here, and we only have 12 guys to guard this frickin' bridge. There's no way. And they are telling you over and over, there's no way. And you're with them all the way up to, in for me at least, until the tank comes over the ridge, you know?
Yeah, then you're like, oh.
And then you're and with about 200 guys behind the tank, and you're like, wait a minute, Tom Hanks might die, you know? Regardless of the information that they gave you, but just telling you, listen, don't invest here because I'm going to systematically kill all these characters off. You, because of the way it's done, you will invest, because if characters are done correctly, it still comes as a surprise. You watch that movie again and you're like, yeah, there was no way these guys were, and even these guys knew they weren't going to die. The only person who was fooled was me. So watching Heat again for the 300th time, I always think Macaulay's just going to go straight to the airport and they're going to leave, you know? He's not going to get that phone call from Voight, who knows what he's doing when he calls him. You're already on your way out anyway, so this information isn't going to do you any good. So here's the information anyway, you know?
Yeah.
And you're like, don't do it, don't do it. Okay, he did it, but he was so goddamn clever about it, he's just going to get away, you know? And now also in the same time, you're rooting for Hannah. Hannah, he's getting away. He's over there. He's getting away. So it's just, I think it's an amazing movie because you end up rooting for everybody, as you said, Lathan. You're rooting for them against all the information you've been given about each and every one of these characters. And that's that's fascinating to me, personally. Except for the slick thing.
that's a minor transgression.
It's got nothing to do with anything.
Anyone listening, you need to see it. It's brilliant, and we all agree on the fact that it's well worth it.
One last thing that I noticed, you know, he makes a big point. He says the speech twice during the film about you're never in the middle of something that you can't walk away from in 20 seconds, and you see the heat coming around a corner. It's a tenet that he lives by. I found it interesting that during the firefight, he goes out of his way to go back and get Chris. And I don't know that it's necessarily him going against his creed, his credo, as his stated philosophy. I thought that stuck out for me this time. The fact that he went out of his way to make sure that he, you know, that Chris got away with him, that he didn't just turn and go. Like he done. But I mean,
it's a foreshadow. It's a foreshadow that he is susceptible to break. His mantra is flexible. You know, it's a very subtle, it's almost a missable point that there are circumstances where he will break his rule, you know, because he is pathological about it.
Right.
The whole film.
But he's a Marine, right?
Yes.
So he's not leaving a man behind,
but
right?
But he's more into that credo. I mean, the movie's named after it, right? If you see the heat coming around the corner, he is so pathological about that credo. And he's so tightly wound that when Edie, Amy Brenneman, is asking him questions at a restaurant, he accuses her of being a cop, you know, virtually.
Why are you asking me questions?
Yeah, he snap his shatter, you know, and he has to put his game, he's put his human face back on.
Right.
5 seconds later, just to, you know, to be able to reengage. It's, you know, but when the chips are down, he is capable of sentimentality, and that's what gets him killed.
Right.
Yep. That's a great point. Great point.
So that's all I got. Heat is a wonderful film. Anyone who has not seen it, highly recommended by all three of us. It's definitely one of those that if you like action films, if you like just good movies, this is a can't miss for you. So let's go down the tubes.
And again, the internet is not something that you just dump something on. It's not a big truck. It's a series of tubes.
You guys should have these. I sent you them earlier today.
I do have them.
Yep, looking at them.
I have them. I'm all good.
The poster, the standard poster campaign, you'll notice on this pack that there's a lot more alt posters for this movie than there were for Excalibur. Also, the poster campaign for Heat is pretty straightforward across most countries. They pretty much stuck with a photo subject for the posters in most cases, or at least a artistic representation of photo stills from the movies. This teaser is just, you know, the diner scene with their names and the title and nothing else. And then you go to the U.S. standard one sheet. If you toggle between 2 and 3, you'll notice that the posters are almost identical. The only thing they do instead of the subway scene, which is the opening, very first thing you see in the movie come into the credits, is that subway shot right there. The only thing they do is they switch it out for the five cops at the dock and exchanges them out when they go to that sort of lighter background version, as opposed to the all photograph version.
I don't like any of these so far. Just thought I'd throw that in there.
Yeah, they're all pretty generic. Standard. They're put together.
The first one's kind of could be iconic, but it's
they don't do a whole lot. And if you go to the British Quad, it's just a reorganization of the same image, which is the next one, which is number 4. Again, it's pretty much just, I mean, literally it's the same image as number 3.
Now we're on
number 6, which is Japan number 2. It's just with him and Edie at the top and Pachito underneath.
Yeah, that's the 80s video cassette box cover one. That's just,
That's a very standard Japanese poster for an American film.
Sure.
Same thing with the next one.
Which one is that? No. What do you want to know? Oh, it's the same.
That's the one with Neil McCauley with the rifle and Pachito.
Yeah, the orange one. Right. Yeah, I'm all out of order.
Japan 3 is the one.
Yeah. I see it now. I got it.
Yeah.
It's kind of oranges. It's peach.
Yeah. It's
okay. It's very Photoshop.
Yes, exactly. So after that is South Korea re-release. I actually like this sort of arrangement a little better. This was also the image that they used for the definitive director's cut domestic Blu-ray release. This was the image that they used for that as well.
And this is Pacino and De Niro at the top with Kilmer in the middle.
No, this is the three of them in a row with Kilmer pointing the rifle down. It's in Korean.
Oh well, that would do it.
Looks like a hydrogen bomb for the first Korean letter too. I don't like this one. So, Stevie, the next one. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Yeah, and it's funny that the background is made together of a montage of three shots of the city from different angles and different distances.
Weird.
It's very weird.
That's a strange choice.
Yeah, it's again jumbled, thrown together. This next image of the guy at the door with the gun on the table. This is a piece of art called Pacific by an artist named Alex Colville. And there's a shot in the film, if you remember, when De Niro goes home and he sets the gun on the table and he walks over to his sliding glass door overlooking the ocean.
Yeah,
it's staged very much like this. It was recreated based on this piece of art because Michael Mann loves this painting.
Oh, that's really cool.
So he staged that shot in the film based on the painting.
Cool.
Yeah. I thought that was a neat little So the first one here is a guy named Aurelio Lorenzo. This is going into the fan created alt poster stuff.
Okay.
Almost like a 70s vibe here.
Very much so. Yeah, it looks more of the more like the hand painted look.
It's a nice picture, but I don't like it as a movie poster.
Okay,
it's good art.
Well, it also technically doesn't have film credits on it either. It's just got the quote.
Yeah. So it's whatever that's called.
Then the next one, Brett Elvidge, is kind of another more designy based one. This is the one I think Hassan you were talking about, which was kind of peachy.
Which one is that?
Yeah, I don't. Not a fan of this one either.
Can you be honest? Can you describe the image?
Brett Elvidge.
Brett Elvidge is the name of the image.
They're not.
Do you get the image names?
No, because I had to download them from the zip, and they downloaded with the dates instead of names. That's why I've been lost this whole time.
Oh, arg. Okay.
If you call out one detail about the image, I'll be able to know I'm with you.
All right, so it's a gradient color scheme from red at the bottom to sort of fuchsia at the top with Al Pacino large central with heat running down the right side.
Okay, I got it.
All right, now your phone will explode.
It is it's another one that could be put together in about 15 minutes in Photoshop with the right cutouts.
The next one, which is blue and cream color scheme, it's by a guy whose work I really like named Chris Malbon.
Definitely a lot going on in it.
Yeah, Chris is no stranger to detail in his work.
Okay.
It's less a movie poster than it is a piece of art based on the film, really.
Hard to describe, Hassan. Heat is on
cargo containers on the right hand side.
Cargo containers that are on ships on the right side.
It's like a it's a blue and cream colored scheme.
Yeah, that's a nice one.
I like the idea.
With the gun, there's a gun in the foreground. Is a Beretta in like the foreground?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The plane in the top right corner. Yes. Okay.
I think the bottom right needs something in it. That's what bothers me about this. I like it, but.
Well, that's probably where the title card would go.
Oh, okay. Right. Of course. Then, yeah, that would look cool. I want to be cool with that.
So the next one is a very 70s styled.
Oh, yeah.
By Jack Belcastro. It's just got that repeated image motif. It's very orange, Hassan.
Okay.
Four De Niro's and five Pacino, or four Pacino's and four De Niro's.
Four De Niro's.
It's great, though. I like this one a lot, Stevie.
It reminds me of an old James Bond poster.
It's got Pacino with a rifle.
Yeah. It just says the heat, it says the heat's on.
Heat is on, yeah.
Yeah.
That's a good one.
Yeah.
I like that.
That's a good one. If I was in the movie theater and I saw that, I'd be like, all right, yeah. You know, that I've seen professional posters that are less involved than that.
Oh yeah.
I mean, this next one, wow. Okay.
Yeah, the next two are by a guy named Krzysztof Domoradzki. He's a Polish artist. His work is absolutely gorgeous. Hassan, this image is one of the only ones, it might be the only one that's in landscape format, not vertical.
Oh, okay. Okay.
And then there's
another
one that follows that's by the same artist.
They're both awesome.
Yes.
Awesome.
Yeah, he does absolutely stunning work.
He's great.
Spoiler alert, they're awesome.
Yeah.
Is that the one with the diamond shapes? The diamonds?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yep.
Okay.
Yep.
The diamond shapes, and then the one following it is it got the word heat in white in big letters down the middle. Chunky shapes to either side.
Mine are all broken up because that's almost at the end of this line here. But that is my favorite one, the second one, the one with the heat going down the middle.
Gotcha.
It's an amazing poster.
Yeah, I think as a graphic designer, I don't think you would use that font, but that's right. That'd be the only caveat, you know, because I think the thing is a work of art with the font. That's the way it is.
Well, and you'll notice if you go back to the other one, he actually uses a variation of that font for the other poster as well. So he's actually tying the two posters together. They're similar in for the font for the actual title. It's just laid out horizontally, and they've got these a few extra angles to the segments. But the basic structure of the font itself is the same. The next one is one I really like. This is by Lafar Posters, and it's just De Niro at the window, but done in just these sort of long vertical stripes. It's all blue with kind of a red spot in the middle, Hassan.
Okay.
Maybe a little, yeah, purple over them.
don't complicate things.
Whatever the fuck it is. I don't like this one.
Oh.
But Stevie likes it.
I love this one. This is just straight up design work.
He's such a drag, Latham.
I know, I'm dragging this. I don't like any of these posters except that one guy from Poland. You're awesome, guy from Poland.
You're saying Pacino is at a window?
No, De Niro. It's the him where he's at the window with the scene we just talked about when he's in his house.
Oh, okay. Gotcha. I see it. Yeah, that's really Art Deco kind of impressionist, you know, kind of situation.
Yeah, it's very minimalistic design.
Yeah.
But I just really like that how that's put together.
And you can tell from the gait of the image that is Pacino. Like it's, you know, he probably used a still or something like that from the film to capture the gait on him because it does seem like that's Pacino. I mean, that De Niro.
Yeah. Oh yeah, absolutely. It's taken from the shot where he's silhouetted against the glass.
Mm-hmm.
So next is actually the same poster four times.
Yeah,
by a company, a studio called Loose Cannon Graphics, and they just posted it, and they just did four colorways.
I feel like I'm looking at like an Arizona iced tea bottle or something. I don't really feel like these.
Yeah, these aren't that great.
Yeah, I think I probably
they're better than I can do. I just don't like them.
So then the next is Maxime Augustine. It's a couple of focal point images. It's De Niro's face. Pacino with the gun and a barrel of a pistol from the bottom with smoke coming out of the
I see that one.
Yeah, it's
that's like a Bond
one. It's okay.
These aren't the kind of stunning visualist kind of thing that Excalibur had.
Yep, like the next one by Mike Gambrill is just, you know, close up of the two heads on either side with Val Kilmer in the middle, who for some reason has most of his face covered by the gun. I'm not sure what the point of covering his face all the way up is.
But yeah, I don't.
Whatever.
I don't like this one.
So the next one is by one of my favorite guys, a guy named Orlando Arecena. Hassan, you've probably seen his stuff before. This has got a sort of kind of a taupe green-orange color scheme with the heat running down the center. Starts off white and turns red.
Okay.
This one's creative. I like this one.
And it's got the credits at the bottom.
Yeah, and it's a...
It's the shootout.
It's kind of... Yeah, it's the shootout, but it's...
I'll tell you something. This guy,
silhouettes.
This guy works solely in Illustrator.
Yeah, you can kind of tell.
This is all vector.
Mm.
But I like it. It's one of the more creative ones.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, if you look him up, his stuff will blow you away. He did a couple of Alien pieces that are absolutely stunning.
What's his name again? I apologize.
Orlando Arecena.
All right.
So the next one is, this is done by one of our guys who works with us pretty regularly, named Scott Saslow. Does all of his movie posters utilizing stock photos, or a lot of his movie posters using stock photos and then graphical depictions of the typography thrown on top. It's just a shot of the city with the word heat in a white box.
Yeah, that's my favorite.
And traffic going down the center.
Yeah, the traffic down a big road going down the center.
That's my favorite.
Oh, nice.
Just because it's you know, it's another minimalist, but it's mood. It captures the whole,
yes,
you know, it captures L.A., which is the biggest character in the film. Yeah.
The next one is by a guy named Tony Stella. Has a very classical sort of painted film poster feel to his artwork.
Yeah, it's decent.
Yeah, I like Tony's work a lot. This is a black border, got kind of a almost like a washed out color look to it, but with De Niro upper right, Pacino in the middle.
With the rifle?
Yeah.
And there's four different fade images of each of them?
No, that's the one we talked about earlier that looked like an old Bond poster.
Okay.
That was the one by Jack Belcastro.
Yeah, okay. I'm just going to listen to you guys talk.
Okay. So then we've got, yeah,
there's only the
vintage
one more.
Warhol tumbler. This is a guy who reimagines modern films as old, like, TV guide ads and stuff like that.
It's looks like it's more of a cover for a book. But it's
fun stuff.
Is that the one with the rated R next to the heat? Okay.
Yes. If you go to his Tumblr, which is Vintage Warhol, on the Tumblr site, he has a ton of this kind of stuff up there, which is really fun to look through. Like, cool guys who just do something different, you know?
Yeah, no, yeah, it's all these artists are super talented. I mean,
so that's our posters. So something I'm going to do real quick is just run through. We're kind of at the point here at the martini. That's right. You know, where does this film rank in its director's library? And as I said at the top of this, that I feel like he has a very definitive line in his films where you have a bunch of movies that are kind of grouped together that are very good, and then you have not very good. But I found this particularly interesting because I pulled up the Rotten Tomatoes rankings for his films.
Okay.
So starting from the top, with a 96 is The Insider, 93 Last of the Mohicans, 93 Thief, 92 Manhunter, 86 Collateral, and 86 Heat.
Wow. Okay.
And then it drops to 68 for Ali and Public Enemies. Drops all the way to 47 for Miami Vice.
Wow.
40 for the,
that's not fair.
40 for The Keep, and 33 for Black Hat.
Huh. Well, I mean, Manhunter is one of my favorite films ever, so it's going to be at the top of mine.
I'm with you, pal. I Manhunter and Heat for me and in his library are far and away the top two.
I agree, and then I'd put Last of the Mohicans way up there.
Agreed.
Insider's a great movie. I don't remember what I gave The Keep. I'm trying to find it in my book. It might be really low.
It's pretty interesting. Having just watched that movie again, and it's got B because of the
there's some images that I remember from
Because it's got that film score from Tangerine Dream.
Yeah, that makes a difference.
That movie has a distinctly early John Carpenter feel.
I can't. Yeah, that's a good way to compare it. I agree. I mean, I barely remember The Keep, so I don't.
It's got a great cast. Gabriel Byrne, Jürgen Prochnow, Scott Glenn, Ian McKellen.
Right. Wow. Did I give it 2 stars? There's no way. Oh, I did. I did. I put Michael Mann films his goose egg. That was my review. I'll have to watch it again. That's pretty low. To get a 2 for me is pretty low. I mean, there's some bad movies ahead of that movie. I think Miami Vice is that's an unfair rating for Miami Vice. I think that's a great movie. I think that's a lot of fun.
Wow. You guys both like that movie a lot more than I did.
Right, Hassan, what do you think of that?
Miami Vice is not a great movie.
Oh, no?
Okay. I like it a lot. I don't think it's a great movie. I think when I first saw it, and I remember at the end, I was like, wait, that's it? that was literally my reaction to how it, because it's not a movie that ends. It just stops. It doesn't really end.
Oh, I think it ends. I think my issue with it is, and also as being a tremendous fan of the TV show,
yeah. Well,
I think my problem with it is, I think it was an opportunity for him to do Miami Vice like he did Heat, and I felt like he really just made the movie as a love letter to the TV fans. I don't feel like he stepped far enough away from the Miami Vice model to make that movie. And I feel he should have.
I think I told you last week, I said, if you're a fan of the TV show, you're probably not going to like the movie too much. I like the way it's shot. I think it's very pretty. It's up there with Collateral and Heat in the way it looks. But after a while, after having seen it a couple of times, I'm used to how not a story it is. But I don't think for a person watching it for the first time, I don't know if they were going to, especially if they're coming off of it as fans of the television show, I don't know how much they were going to come away with it. And I didn't, you know, if you recall, the only glowing thing I gave you was the opening scene. That was the only thing I said was fantastic. So I didn't expect you to love it. I would put it as 4th in my list of Michael Mann films. It would be Heat and then Collateral and then
Last of the Mohicans
and then Miami Vice and then Manhunter. I like it. It's just not above Last of the Mohicans.
No, there's definitely a nostalgia aspect to Manhunter I'm sure for Lathan and myself.
Absolutely.
But there's something about that movie and where it kind of hit at that time. I felt that it's so good. And seeing the later iterations of it, I can definitely appreciate the change, you know, I can, the updated versions, the more, you know, modern, real sort. I mean, and again, watching Manhunter, it plays like a definitely more serious version of a long Miami Vice episode. But, you know, that was just kind of the visual style that Mann was in at the time.
Right.
So I don't have a big issue with that. That doesn't bother me in any way, really. It definitely bothers me more in L.A. Shakedown, but I'm seriously doing you when you watch this.
I don't know. I have to watch it, but I don't know if I want to. Your head is going to explode when you watch it. It's not as long as Heat, at least, right?
It's like an hour and 40 minutes or something.
Okay. Ooh, that is a long time, though. That's virtually 2 hours of watching.
So, all right. So, there you have it.
Go see Heat.
Heat. If you haven't seen it, you should. Thanks, guys. Just a quick thanks to Purple Planet Music once again for the opening, for our opening music. Please go to cinementalpod.com for additional content of the poster images that accompany all of the Down the Tubes discussions from our episodes. And don't forget to subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. And in the words of our friend Truman Burbank,
good afternoon, good evening, and good night.